let's move on to the beginning of a two-chapter study of the sun. When people ask, what's the closest star? But, you know, the answer, you know, people trying to think of some extra solar system object, the closest star, class, happens to be the sun. If you're looking for the next closest star, that's the star closest to our solar system. Okay? And you remember what we said back in chapter 1? If the sun were reduced in size to a basketball, the nearest star would be another basketball 4,000 miles away. Space, our galaxy, and we're in a fairly dense arm of our galaxy, consists of basketballs separated by thousands of miles. And that's in a star-rich region of a galaxy. You go to intergalactic space, the trackless trillions and trillions of miles of space between galaxies, these voids where there's no stars. Let's take a look at the sun. Here's a depiction of the size of the Earth relative to the surface of the sun. The sun has a million times the volume of the Earth. Okay? It's got about 1,000 times the diameter. The Earth is about 8,000 miles in diameter, roughly. The sun is about 800,000 miles in diameter. Look at how small the Earth looks compared to the sun. The sun is huge compared to the sun, or to the Earth. I want you to remember that. About a million times the volume, you know, about 1,000 times the diameter. You just take the equation for the volume of a sphere, 4/3 pi r cubed. Is that right, Joey? We have a doctoral student in math sitting here, so I want to make sure I get those. Is that right? Okay. Here's the approximate size of the Earth compared to the sun. You see how huge it is by comparison? We're nothing. We're a speck. What did I tell you? On a speck, on a speck. What is man, the psalmist said, when I consider the heavens? What is man that thou art mindful of him? And yet, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. That's what astronomy teaches us. Let's take a look at the sun. We'll strip it away like layers of an onion, like a Mozart piano concerto. You know, if you take a look at the 50 greatest works of music in the Western repertoire, 25 of them would be Mozart piano concertos, according to one eminent music historian. He wrote, what, 31? The reason not all 31 would be on the list is because 6 of them he wrote for his inept niece, who would not have been able to play something more challenging. But anyway, our sun is a large star. You may have heard that the sun is a small star. It's not a small star. Our sun is a large, it's not a huge star, it's not a giant star, but as stars go, it'd be larger than most. You know that most stars, we'll see this in the next chapter, we can't even see them. They're red or brown dwarf stars, not luminous enough for even us to see them, with just a few exceptions in recent years. It's thought that our Milky Way galaxy is estimated to have 200 billion solar masses. That doesn't mean 200 billion stars. We may have trillions of stars if you count all of these red dwarfs and brown dwarfs that we can't even see. There may be tens or dozens more of them than what we do see. Let's take a look at this. So we have, I want you to understand, our sun is a relatively large star. It's a second generation star. What does that mean? Our solar system, consisting of these rocky planets primarily, contain a lot of heavy elements. Elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. You know, a star like ours, as we'll see in the next few chapters, starts out as predominantly hydrogen and a little bit of helium, the two most common elements in the universe by far. Probably 90 to 93% of the entire universe is hydrogen. And hydrogen, if it's heated up to a high enough temperature, through a what's called a proton-proton chain reaction, can fuse into helium. And that fusion of those hydrogen nuclei to form a helium nuclei through a two- or three-step process that we'll talk about later generates an enormous amount of energy through the process of nuclear fusion. Eventually, if the star core gets hot enough because of the mass of the star, the helium can actually fuse and form carbon and oxygen. And eventually, magnesium and a few other elements, if it's a big enough star and has enough mass. But no star, no matter how massive, can fuse any object heavier than iron. There's only one way to make all the elements above iron, beyond iron, on the periodic table, and that is through supernova explosions, these cataclysmic eruptions of massive stars that produce unbelievable amounts of energy. And it's only in those indescribable explosions that there's enough power to overcome the repulsive forces, the Coulomb force, electrostatic repulsion, and a multi-proton nucleus of these heavy atoms to overcome that repulsion and cause them to bind together and form heavier elements. And so because of the what astronomers do, according to the current model, is they measure the amount of heavy elements in a star or its planets, as in our solar system. When you see a preponderance of heavy elements, the rocky planets, the terrestrial planets, the silicates, the gold, the silver, the iron, all these, the uranium, the radioactive isotopes, you know that those elements had to come from the explosions of a supernova in our vicinity at some point in the past. That's the current model. Now, there's several layers in the sun. From the outside moving in, let's take a look at them. You have the corona, kind of this white, these white jets surrounding the sun. And then you going in, you have the chromosphere right here. You have the photosphere, which is strip away the chromosphere, you get the photosphere. Chromosphere means color sphere. Photosphere means light circle or light sphere. And then you get the convection zone here, this large area right here. We'll describe each of these in a little more detail. And then you have the radiative zone. And at the base, the core. The core is the interior 10% of the star. That is where all of the nuclear fusion reactions are taking place in the sun. It's only in the middle 10% of the sun. Let's take a look at the corona. It's the top layer of the solar atmosphere. It only can be seen during an eclipse because it's so diffuse. Millions of miles high. It's constantly changing. You can see holes called coronal holes here where you don't see any portion of the corona. You can see here there are gaps as you look around the entire corona. You have streamers, which are long extensions of the corona in the equatorial regions. The corona can be 3 to 17 million degrees Fahrenheit, which, as it turns out, is about 1,000 times greater than the surface temperature of the sun, which is about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, the interior, we'll see this in a future chapter, the interior of the sun, where all the fusion reactions are taking place, is about 15 million degrees Kelvin. So that might be 20 million degrees or so Fahrenheit. That's the hottest portion of the sun. But after the core, the next hottest portion is not the radiative zone or the surface, but it's the corona, which is between 3 and 17 million degrees Fahrenheit, 1,000 degrees hotter than the surface of the sun. It's still not understood why that is. It doesn't really make sense, does it? There's a couple of theories for it, but really none has garnered, you know, overwhelming support. So for our purposes, we'll just leave it at that. I think it's important to know that the corona is extremely hot. It's hotter than much hotter, 1,000 times hotter than the surface of the sun. Only the core itself, where all of those fusion reactions are taking place, is hotter. A corona actually has been detected around some other stars, which is interesting. Okay, let's look at the chromosphere, the color sphere, thin layer above the photosphere, which is the next layer down. This is about 6,000 miles in diameter, 15 or 25,000 degrees Fahrenheit, 15,000 degrees Kelvin, much cooler than the corona. Only visible during eclipses, just like the corona. The main feature are what are called spicules. It's these little kind of grass-like emanations, fairly short, fairly consistent, along the surface. Jets of gas that rise up through the photosphere here, through the chromosphere. They're about 5,000 miles long on average. And they are very temporary, in effect, lasting maybe 5 to 15 minutes, 10 minutes on average. They rise, hold their place there, and then sink back, going at a fairly rapid rate of about 15 miles per second. Here's a picture of these spicules on the surface of the on the solar surface, constantly moving, rising, falling. And then the photosphere. You'll notice here in the photosphere, sunspots and granules. And you see the granules here surrounding this sunspot. Now, the photosphere comes from the Greek words for light sphere or light circle. That is actually the part of the sun that we actually can see. It's the bottom layer of the sun's atmosphere. The other layers are transparent above it. The layer where the sun is no longer transparent. The solar temperature at the photosphere, which we might call the surface, is 5,800 degrees Kelvin, roughly 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's composed of convection cells, looks like cereal over here, called granules. That's the composition of the photosphere. These granules are about 500 miles wide on average, and they have dark boundaries, which it now is understood represents cooler gas falling back down into the lower levels of the solar surface, constantly churning like boiling water the surface of the sun. Each granule here only lasts for about 8 minutes. And here we see a depiction of cooler gas rising. And as it rises, it starts falling back down to where it heats up. And as it heats, it rises back up. As it approaches the surface, it cools, comes back down. And there's that constant process taking place on the surface of the sun. Here's a close-up. You can see these granules. This is just an instantaneous, very, you know, several thousandth of a second image. If you would see an actual moving picture, a video of the solar surface, this would all be just constantly churning, except for the dark spots, which are more permanent. Here we see the granules on the photosphere surrounding a dark spot on the sun. Let's talk about those dark spots. Here's a depiction of one of them. These are holes, some of them the size of the Earth, in the photosphere of the sun. They last a few hours to a few months or several months. Why are they darker? They're darker because they're cooler. In fact, they're maybe 4,000 degrees Kelvin as opposed to the photosphere surface in general. Some of those granules would be measured at 6,000 degrees Kelvin. And how do we determine that? We covered that back in Chapter 2, looking at the Planck curves, looking at the color. We also talked about the Stefan-Boltzmann law, that energy is associated with temperature to the fourth power. And so if you look at 4,000 degrees Kelvin, 4 to the fourth power is 256. Just looking at 6 to the fourth power is 1296. So you see the energy output at 6,000 degrees is significantly more than it is at 4,000 degrees. So there's so much less energy at 4,000 degrees, making it much cooler and less energetic, and that's what causes these dark spots. So you need to remember that the dark spots, the sunspots, are areas of cooler temperature on the surface of the sun in the photosphere. Why are they cooler? The current model indicates that it's because of the magnetic field of the sun that blocks along certain field lines, blocks certain energy from radiating upward at that specific point, and so it maintains the cool surface temperature for a certain period of time. There's a sunspot cycle of 11 years. We see the numbers of sunspots increase to a peak and then fall off to a trough. It's a predictable cycle that lasts for 11 years, going from a trough to a peak. The latest peak, as I recall, was 2000 to 2001. So we're like halfway through the cycle right now at the bottom of the sunspot cycle. So if you had a solar scope now, you have one at the university that you've used, you would see few, if any, sunspots right now. But wait 5 or 6 years, you'll see several of them on the surface. Those sunspots have a dramatic impact, by the way, on communications on Earth. For example, in amateur radio, I've learned, long-distance communications are virtually impossible when the sunspots are at their low level. When sunspots are at or near the peak, anybody can be doing long-distance communications all over the world because of the boost obtained by the sunspot frequency. Here's a couple more images of sunspots amidst all those granules. And again, don't think that these are fixed. These are constantly churning, only lasting a few minutes or several minutes. A few other solar phenomena would be solar flares, these white areas of the sun, sudden violent explosions on the surface of the sun. The current theory is that the sunspots shear or twist the magnetic field lines, and as those lines reconnect, they release tremendous amounts of energy, causing a solar flare, the equivalent of maybe 10 million hydrogen bombs going off when that happens. They appear as white regions, can last for a few seconds to several hours, tremendous sources of radiation, which can disrupt telecommunications on Earth, and power line surges have been caused by these solar flares. Here's the famous, what was called a seahorse flare that happened in 1972. Some of them have shapes that resemble something like this, in this case a seahorse, against an orange background. Solar prominences are these giant loops that protrude from the solar surface. These things can be up to 200,000 miles above the solar surface. They can last for weeks. Okay, I want to at least introduce here before we quit tonight. And by the way, if you look at the, I just posted some homework assignments for next week, okay? I think they're like 7 questions for chapters 7, 8, and 10. All right, that'll help you for the test. So again, at the end of each, and I'll tell you what, we'll have time next week for me to review, do a little bit of review for the test, if that'd be helpful. Now let's conclude for the last 5 minutes here talking about the sun and the theory of relativity. You know, Albert Einstein, famous German-American physicist, 1879 to 1955, authored the special theory of relativity in 1905. As it turns out, that was only one of 5 articles, any of which would have deserved a Nobel Prize that he wrote in 1905. He didn't get a Nobel Prize for this paper. He got one, I think it was for the photoelectric effect. He also wrote one on Brownian motion, and I don't remember what the 4th one was, but that was just 100 years ago. The special theory of relativity contained the famous equation E equals MC squared, the mass energy transformation equation that any amount of matter is the equivalent of just an unbelievably great amount of energy. You take any mass times the speed of light squared, which is an extraordinary number, and that equals the latent energy that it can be converted into. That's what happens in nuclear reactors and in nuclear bombs and in the sun. It turns out this equation in 1905, just 100 years ago, explained the mechanism by which the sun produces the prodigious amount of energy that it does. Nobody could understand, once we were able to measure this solar output in terms of energy, what in the world is causing this? This equation answered that question, and we'll look at that story in Chapter 11. The special theory also has the theory of time dilation based on velocity, that the faster an object is moving, the slower time passes relative to a stationary frame of reference. We've mentioned this before. When you're driving down the street at 40 miles an hour, you are aging more slowly compared to somebody sitting here on campus. That's time dilation based on velocity. The faster you go, the greater the effect. If you hit the speed of light, time ceases to exist. The general theory of relativity, 10 years later, 1915, contained the theory of gravity and of space-time. Let's talk about this principle of equivalence. Einstein called this the happiest idea or discovery of his life. And what was that? It was simply this. He came to the conclusion that there's no way to determine or to distinguish between the effects of free fall and zero gravity. For example, falling down a bottomless pit or elevator shaft. You're weightless, aren't you? You know, what if you're at the 110th floor of the Sears Tower and the doors open and you step in reflexively and the elevator's on floor number one? That was a malfunction. The door just opened accidentally and you're hurtling through the abyss of dark space. You're weightless, aren't you? I don't know if you're going to notice it, but you are. You can if that happens to you, pull a pen out of your pocket and just let go of it and watch it. It's going to be like floating in air, like an astronaut on the space shuttle. If you have an apple in your purse, just kind of let it go of your hand, and there it is, just floating with you. You're weightless because you're in free fall. Einstein said by the way, that's why my kids, I've always trained them, never be the first one on an elevator. I give them the 10 rules of elevator etiquette. Rule number one is always stand back and let others get on first in the event that there's no elevator there. I happen to know an attorney that represented somebody in a different city that had that very case. She was standing at the 10th floor of this old building. The door opened. She reflexively stepped in to a dark abyss. And the worst part of that fall was not knowing what was down there. You know, it was dark. You can't see. This is her last memory. What's down there? Some type of equipment? Who knows what's down there? And she landed down there. And she survived miraculously. She survived. But she couldn't even bring herself to scream. She was so hurt. And people didn't know she was down there. And then her fear became, well, not elevated, that it was actually above her, above the 10th floor, started coming down to the first floor, and she could feel it, the vibrations as that car was coming down. Was she going to be squashed down there? She wasn't. She was eventually extricated. My friend sued the building and the elevator company for negligence and received. What do you think that case was worth? What would you take for that? Two broken legs and just the fear. I won't tell you the answer. It's confidential, but it's not as much as I would have taken. But anyway, falling down here, here's the most exciting idea of Einstein's life. There's no way to tell the difference between falling down in bottomless pit like this elevator shaft or being in zero gravity. Incidentally, do you know that the astronauts on the space shuttle, 99 people out of 100, when you ask them, why are they floating around up there, what are they going to say? Because it's zero gravity. It's not zero gravity. They're 100 miles above the Earth's surface. They're at 4,100 miles from the center of the Earth instead of us on the surface at 4,000. That's only 2% difference. They're not floating around because there's no gravity. They have extensive gravity up there. Why are they floating? Because they're in an elevator shaft falling around the Earth continuously. That's their orbit. They're in a state of perpetual free fall. They're not in zero gravity. It mimics zero gravity. And that's what Einstein said. If you would wake up someday, let's say you were put in suspended animation, and 1,000 years later you were awakened in your cubicle, and you had no way to know if you were a trillion miles from Earth in true zero gravity, or if you were in orbit around the Earth in free fall, and you had no windows, you could not tell which condition you were in. They are equivalent. Now, you may say, well, so what? This seemingly simple proposition contains an absolutely phenomenal conclusion or application in terms of the nature of the universe that we'll return to next week. 2 weeks ago, we concluded by looking at this issue of the sun and the theory of relativity. And let me just go over this with you briefly, because we didn't quite finish this material. You know, Einstein's special theory of relativity, just about 100 years ago, 1905, that was the year that he wrote those four papers, any one of which deserved the Nobel Prize. He didn't get the Nobel Prize for the special theory of relativity, but rather for an article that he wrote on the photoelectric effect. But in the special theory is where we see the mass-energy transformation equation, E equals MC squared, that any amount of mass can be converted into an equivalent amount of energy, which is just an unbelievably large number, because you're taking the mass times the speed of light squared. And that explains, of course, nuclear weapons and nuclear power. And then he comes back 10 years later with the general theory of relativity, and that's what we're going to be talking about for a few minutes tonight, that had to do with the concept of gravity. And I mentioned last time that this principle of equivalence that Einstein called the happiest idea of his life. And the idea is this: there's no way to distinguish between being in a zero-gravity environment or being in free fall down an elevator shaft. The effect is identical, and there's no way for you to differentiate between the two. So if you were put in suspended animation for 1,000 years, and you wake up in some dark cubicle, and you discover that you're weightless, there's no way, Einstein said, for you to know if your cubicle is in zero gravity somewhere a trillion miles from the Earth, or if you're in free fall orbit about the Earth or some other planet. The two effects are identical. So here's our elevator shaft. You remember I said that falling down that shaft, it is indistinguishable. Well, actually, it's not quite indistinguishable, but for our purposes, we'll consider it indistinguishable from being in a zero-gravity environment trillions of miles from the Earth. And so when you see these astronauts floating in the space shuttle, 99 out of 100 people, more than that, will say, why are they floating? Because they're in zero gravity. They're not in zero gravity. They're in free fall acceleration orbit around the Earth. And what is orbit? You're just constantly falling. But you have enough acceleration, you have enough velocity, that you never fall down to the Earth. You're constantly going around it. Think of it this way. The shuttle's 100 miles above the surface of the Earth. The radius of the Earth is 4,000 miles. So you're going from 4,000 miles from the center of the Earth to 4,100, you know, a couple of percent more, and all of a sudden you're going to be weightless? Absolutely not. So here's this astronaut placed in suspended animation in a sealed laboratory on her space on a spaceship in Earth's orbit, and she awakens many years later, discovers she's weightless. There's no way for her to know if that weightlessness is caused by reduced gravity, because the ship is in a zero or reduced gravity environment, or because of free fall orbital acceleration around the Earth. Now, the principle of equivalence seems simple and even intuitive, but it has profound consequences, as we'll see. To what? To the nature of the universe. The key points. Gravity is essentially neutralized in the falling elevator shaft or the bottomless pit, making the effect of free fall the equivalent of zero gravity. Now, here was Einstein's conclusion, that if gravity can be nullified so easily as to be in free fall down an elevator shaft, then the so-called Newtonian force of gravity must be an illusion. You know, Newton himself struggled with the concept of gravity. He knew gravity was what was holding the moon in orbit around the Earth, for example. But what was it? You know, he tried to examine it. He tried to detect it. There was no force there that could be detected. It was a mysterious force. When you hold an apple or a pen and drop it, what is the force that's capturing that object and making it fall down? We can't detect it. We can't feel it. It's a mysterious force. And Newton just considered it force at a distance. That was an inherent property between any two items of mass. It was a force that was subject to the inverse square law, the force diminished by the reciprocal of the distance squared. But Newton could not explain what this force was, and it remained a mystery for 300 years. But Einstein, deduces that if the force of gravity can be essentially nullified just by stepping into an open elevator shaft, then is this that significant a force? Is it an illusion? And I mentioned last time, what about a cheap refrigerator magnet that your mother used to use to hold your spelling tests up on the refrigerator? Just think of it. That little magnet overcame and outpowered the entire gravitational force of planet Earth. Einstein applies the principle of equivalence to beams of light. And, you know, he said this. Let's assume that you're on a spaceship somewhere in zero gravity. So you're way beyond any orbit of the sun or a planet. You're trillions of miles from our solar system, somewhere in interstellar space. Now, if you shine a laser beam or a light back here from A forward, it's going to hit the bulkhead right there in the middle at point B, right? Well, that's right. And so then he said, okay, now according to the principle of equivalence, the same thing should happen if we take that spaceship and put it in free fall orbital acceleration around the planet Earth. So we look at this. Here's a shuttle in a spaceship in free fall orbit around the Earth, and we fire our laser beam from point A up here toward point B. Now, once we apply the trigger and the beam is starting to move, what happens? The space shuttle is moving a little bit in its orbit around the Earth. And so you would think that the laser beam should hit out here some point at point B. But in fact, it hits here at point C. Now, how is that possible? Light always travels in a straight line. And for it to hit C, light has to be curved. And, you know, Einstein said, according to the equivalence principle, it must hit point C because it must be identical to the spaceship that's in zero gravity. In which case, you remember, the beam hit right here in the middle of the bulkhead. So it must be the same. But for that to happen, the beam of light must be crooked. And we know that that's not possible. So what is going on here? Either the principle of equivalence is flawed, or light sometimes doesn't travel in a straight line. Einstein comes up with this insight. There is a third alternative, and it is this. The laser beam hits point C because space-time is curved down because of the mass of the Earth. And it curves the space-time continuum, which defines reality. Light has no mass, so it's not affected by mass or gravity. The reason that light beam seems to be curving down and going to point C on the space shuttle is because the space-time continuum in which that light beam is traveling is being curved by the Earth's strong, substantial mass, which results in curvature in the field. So again, Newton said gravity was a force at a distance. Einstein says gravity is not a force. This is the general theory of relativity, 1915, but results from the curvature of space-time associated with any object of mass. All mass warps space-time. Your body is warping space-time. The pen in your hand is warping space-time. Most of these are at such a microscopic level they can't be detected. The amount of the warp depends on the mass and the compactness of the object. For example, a compact white dwarf star that we'll investigate in a future chapter, or a neutron star with one tablespoon weighing 10 billion tons. That is very dense, and the gravitational effect is pronounced. Now, the sun, because it's a million times approximately more massive than the Earth, several million times more massive than the moon, results in a much greater warp of space-time than either the Earth or the moon. It's sometimes compared to a rubber mat with a tennis ball in the middle, and imagine, you know, rolling marbles past the tennis ball. They essentially are going to be traveling in a straight line, aren't they? But if you replace that tennis ball in the middle of your rubber mat with a shot put and you start rolling your marbles past it, what's going to happen? There's a big dimple there in the middle, isn't it? And it's going to curve the rubber surface and cause the line of travel of those marbles to change. And that's essentially Einstein's view of gravity. Remember, light is not bending. It's the space-time in which it exists that defines our existence is bending. You would not notice the curvature of space-time, but would assume you were traveling in a straight line. This is the first explanation of how gravity works. A mystery to Newton, force at a distance. It's been confirmed over and over again by experiment. So here's our rubber sheet without any weight in the middle, and here's an ant walking across our sheet in a straight line. Now let's say that you put a heavy metal paperweight right smack in the middle. What's going to happen? It's going to bend that rubber sheet down, and then we'll have our ant do his course again, and what's going to happen? He's going to go like this. The ant thinks it's walking in a straight line, and as far as it can, it is. But from our perspective, it appears to be a greatly distorted or curved route. What if this ant could actually escape this two-dimensional reality and just go from here to here without having to go through this kind of tunnel here? Would this be an example of warp travel? You know, Tim, you were mentioning Star Trek. Well, here it is. What is that? The warp engine. This is one of the warp engines on the Starship Enterprise. You know how Captain Kirk would say warp factor 2 or warp factor 7? You know, is that what they were doing? Going from point A to B without having to go through the entire warp itself. That was the theoretical basis for warp travel, which, by the way, is not seriously considered to be a physical reality. Now, this was an interesting hypothesis, but how in the world are you going to test it? You know, what we'd like to do is see how the sun, because it's the most massive close-by object, how can we have the sun warping the position of an object in space? It's so bright we can't see anything. Well, Einstein said there's a solar eclipse that's going to happen. I believe it was in March of 1919. Or May 29, 1919. So Sir Arthur Eddington, who is a British astronomer, travels to some equatorial area. I don't remember if it was South Pacific. But he goes there during the solar eclipse, and he's able to measure a star in the Hyades star cluster as having been deflected 1.75 arc seconds, which is exactly what the general theory of relativity predicted. So here we have, during the total solar eclipse, this star that appeared to be here was actually here because that light path was being bent or curved by the space-time continuum because of the solar mass being so huge. It was later determined, by the way, that Eddington fudged the results of that exam, and it was discredited. But it was subsequently, the basic theory was confirmed by numerous other studies. And in more recent years, by the Hipparchus satellite, which we'll talk about later tonight, to within 1% of the theory. There's Einstein and Eddington. Now, let's conclude this chapter by talking about one final thing that's kind of interesting, and that's the concept of time in the general theory of relativity. Einstein said that space and time are both interrelated and not independent. Both are affected by gravity. Now, think about that. You know, he said the space-time continuum of reality is bent around massive objects, but Einstein said the time itself is affected by massive objects, by gravitational attraction. Very interesting idea. Time dilation, the slowing down of time, occurs not just when we're traveling at high velocities, but also when we're approaching very significant gravitational masses. Time slows down relative to some stationary frame of reference. We mentioned the clock in the basement at the Harvard Physics Building early in the 20th century, that famous experiment where it was determined that the atomic clock in the basement actually ran slower than a clock on the second floor. Why? It's closer to the center of the Earth. It's closer to a stronger gravitational force. It's closer to the center of mass of the Earth. And that resulted in greater time dilation in the basement than on the second or third floor. That's why I say if you want to age more slowly, be on the first floor of the dorm, not the second or third floor. You will age more slowly. You age more quickly on the higher floors. You burn up quickly. Actually, the effect cannot even be measured. Maybe it can be measured, but it's a very tiny fraction of 1 second living your whole 4 years on this campus in the second or third floor. How many floors are there in the dorms? Three? Four? Yeah. 1976 Mars Viking mission that we looked at back in Chapter 6, radio signal sent that grazed the sun. It was delayed to within 0.01% of what the theory of relativity proposed. Unbelievable confirmation. There was the Viking mission sending a radio transmission to the Earth and having that, this is distorted here, but the transmission was actually bent by the sun's gravitational attraction. Okay, let me conclude with this. I just jotted this down on a napkin at a hotel I was at a few years ago. I was having breakfast with this guy. I was about 5 minutes late. I said I was calculating velocity-induced time dilation on this napkin. So he was kind of fascinated by that, and I ended up just putting it together, this slide here. But if you look at this moving object in this column, what is its velocity? What is the velocity as a percentage of the speed of light, v divided by c, and what is its gamma, or what is the time dilation, the factor by which time seems to be slowing down relative to somebody in a non-moving frame of reference? Well, as you can see here, if you look at a car going down the highway at 60 miles per hour, it is hardly even measurable, the gamma. You know, it's 1.0. You are aging. We just don't have enough decimals there to show. You're aging more slowly going 60 miles an hour than somebody sitting here, but we can't measure it. Really, the effect of time dilation based on velocity, not gravity, only becomes noticeable when you get down here to about 90% of c of the speed of light, 167,000 miles per second out of 186,000 miles per second. At that speed, you have a gamma of about 2.3. Okay, so what somebody from a stationary frame of reference is moving, what takes 2.3 years, for you, it will take 1 year. And so there we begin to see the gamma, but really only when you get down here to 98% of the speed of light, then the gamma is a 5. So, for example, if you travel to a star 200 light years away at 0.98 or 98% of the speed of light, your trip takes 200 years to someone on Earth because it's 200 light years away. But with a gamma of 5, you perceive the trip only takes you about 40 years. Now look at when you get up here to 99%. Well, the gamma is only 7. 99.9, the gamma is 22. 99.95, the gamma is just under 30. But look at it, not until we get down here to 99.9999% of the speed of light does the gamma really start shooting up to over 700. And really, for intergalactic travel, you got to be here. This is 1 mile per second slower than the speed of light. Instead of 186,000 miles per second, you're going at 185,999 miles per second. Indistinguishable, but that tiny fraction is enough to give you a gamma of 22,360. So, for example, travel to the Andromeda Galaxy 3 million light years away at this gamma right here, you'll make it in about 134 years. Carl Sagan used to refer to that. The problem is, how do you get something going this percentage of the speed of light? Now, if you can hit 100% of light speed, then you're traveling at 186,000 miles per second. Velocity divided by speed of light is 1. And most importantly, over here, your gamma is infinite. So time literally ceases to exist for you at that speed. Of course, it's impossible to attain that speed because, physically, you're going to need more and more fuel to go faster and faster. And the more fuel you have, the more your weight. And so the more fuel it's going to take to go faster. It's a self-defeating cycle. Okay, so there's the general theory. Basic idea is it was a very different view of gravity than Newton had predicted. It is the fact that mass bends space-time, and it's a revolutionary different view of reality.